across Northern Ireland, on your radio, and on BBC Sounds. This is The Stephen Nolan
Show! Hello, you are listening to The Nolan Show with Holly Hamilton this week. I feel like I should be here with a mop bucket and a pair of rubber gloves. It feels like the clean-up operation after the election last week, so we do know who's in, who's out. The question is, what's next? And Sir Keir Starmer, the new Prime Minister, is in Northern Ireland today. He's been speaking to the main party leaders here. So we wanted to know, what would you like to ask him? What should the priorities be? And how will this government deal with those existing issues here, like public services, Casement Park, the Windsor Framework, the health service? I mean, I could go on, and depends on what order you want those things dealt with. Today we did hear from members of the DUP, UUP and the TUV on what they would like to see, what they would like to say to Sir Keir Starmer, and how they reflect on the election, how they reflect on their results, and what's next, of course, for those who did lose their seat. We will be dealing with that issue in a little bit more detail on tomorrow's show. We were also reflecting today on another weekend of football. We are into the business end of the Euros now, just four teams left. We've got England, the Netherlands, Spain and France. Who's going to be in the final? Who is going to win it? Is it going to be England? Get in touch, as always, on any of today's stories or anything that you want to tell us on social media, or you can send us an email, nolan@bbc.co.uk. We'll be back tomorrow morning. Have a great Monday. The Stephen Nolan Show! Hello, good morning. It is Monday, the 8th of July. It's Holly Hamilton here for Stephen Nolan today. How are we all doing? I think I only just about caught up with my sleep after last Thursday night / Friday morning. There's only really three things that we've been talking about over the last few days. Certainly in my house anyway. We've got the election, football and the weather. We are going to talk about two out of the three on the show today, because one of those is just too depressing. You can decide which one. But yes, it's the Monday after the general election, and Sir Keir Starmer, the newly elected Prime Minister, is here in Northern Ireland. He's in Belfast right now. Who knows? He could be listening in a taxi on his way to Stormont as we speak. And he will be wondering what the good people of Northern Ireland have to say. This is your opportunity to tell him. What would you want to tell the Prime Minister this morning? What's your priority? What's your message? What have you been talking about in your house? Get in touch, 03030 80 55 55. Lots to get through on the show today. The dust settling after that election last week. But what is likely to be on the agenda? Will it be more money for health? Does Sinn Féin's results put more pressure on calls for a border poll? What about Casement Park? Well, the newly appointed Secretary of State, Hilary Benn, told our reporter, Kelly Bonner, that Casement Park will be built, but urged people to bear with him.
Back in April, Secretary of State, you told my colleague Mark Crothers that you'd do everything in your power to get Casement Park built. You are in power now. Will Casement be built, and can you guarantee it will be built in time to host the Euros?
Well, Casement Park is a very important project. It's been a long-held objective of the executive, as you will be aware. There are two issues. The first is the cost, which has continued to escalate. I think originally when it was conceived, it was going to be something like £77 million. I have yet to receive a full detailed briefing, which I will get tomorrow, on where the current estimated cost, but it's a lot more money than that. And there's a certain amount in the pot, but not enough to cover what is the increased cost. And the second is, of course, we're into, well, definitely extra time on trying to get it built for the Euros. And that's about discussions with UEFA. So I am looking at this urgently. It's probably the most urgent issue on my desk. But one way or another, if it's possible in time for the Euros, if not one way or another, the Casement Park will have to be built to complete the project, which has included, of course, Windsor Park, the Kingspan for football and for rugby, and Casement Park for the GAA. So I'm looking to see what can be done.
Just when will you make that decision? I mean, it's rolling on.
Well,
now.
I think the honest answer is as soon as I am in a position to announce anything. So you just have to bear with me.
Bear with me. And Sir Keir Starmer has said, in his words, he wants to reset the British government's relationship with Northern Ireland and to bring back stability and certainty. I think we'll be hearing those words quite a lot today. We are joined now by our political reporter, Brendan Hughes, who is at Stormont Castle. Good morning to you, Brendan.
Good morning, Holly.
First of all, have you caught up in your sleep?
I don't think I was expecting as early a start today, to be quite honest. So I think perhaps a couple more days will be needed from a lot of the press pack, definitely after the whirlwind couple of days that there have been, and indeed for the politicians as well, considering that now the new UK government is really swinging into action. And we're seeing that with this UK whistle-stop tour of the nations by the Prime Minister. He was, of course, in Scotland yesterday, meeting with the First Minister, John Swinney. Overnight he came to Northern Ireland. He arrived in Northern Ireland, and today he's meeting with the political leaders here at Stormont on the Stormont estate. Then, of course, he's going off to Wales later on today. So, really, it's a big effort by the Prime Minister to really get out and meet with the various members and leaders of the UK nations and show that really that the UK government is back in business and wants to try and repair and restore relations on all fronts.
Yeah, it's all about messaging, really, and optics, I suppose, too, and this, you know, stability and certainty. That's the message he wants to convey today. And we see the front page of the Belfast Telegraph, you know, quoting him, "My 10-year plan will turn the page in Northern Ireland." There's a lot of pages to be turned, though, Brendan, and I do wonder what chapter he's going to start on.
Yes, absolutely. I think as you're right, definitely the message of this first couple of days is, well, first of all, the UK government, in terms of the Labour Party, its message in the election was very much about stability. It was arguing that really a Labour administration would return the UK to some sort of level of stability that we hadn't seen in the years following the EU referendum and the fallout and negotiations over what to do around Brexit. So really, the Prime Minister, the new Prime Minister, wants to turn her page, as he would say, in that respect. And in terms of what he will do in relation to Northern Ireland, I think that there is plenty on his plate. We've already heard there from the new Secretary of State for Northern Ireland, Hilary Benn, in relation to Casement Park, which is very much one of the big talking points for his in-tray, what he's going to do around that. And I didn't really think from that response that you got yesterday, that Kelly Bonner got yesterday from him whenever he was speaking to the press, that he really committed to anything in particular. Of course, he wants to see Casement Park built, but wasn't exactly saying that it will definitely happen in time for the Euros tournament in 2028, but he is saying that he wants to do all in his power to do so. But there's plenty of other issues that the Prime Minister and the new Northern Ireland Secretary will have to get to grips with, not least, of course, the Legacy Act, something that was written into the Labour manifesto that they are pledging to repeal and replace the Legacy Act, which of course has caused controversy, has been opposed by all of the Stormont parties here, as well as the Irish government. So that will be very much top of the agenda. And then, of course, Stormont funding as well. I think that all of the parties here have been arguing that Northern Ireland has been underfunded in the years of Conservative governments here. And so therefore, they want to see that Northern Ireland gets a larger slice of the pie from the UK Treasury in future years. We, of course, have some sort of level of new agreement, which means that Northern Ireland will get more funding in future financial years that will try and stabilise public services here. But I think that there's going to be further negotiations between the UK government as well as the Northern Ireland executive as to what the finances will look like in the next few months and indeed years ahead.
Yeah, just to pick up on the Casement Park issue, because we heard his initial answer was clearly one of those prepared answers. He knew it was going to come up whenever he comes to Belfast. But then when he was pushed on it, as you say, he didn't really have anything further to add in terms of anything definitive. And you wonder, you know, especially when he says it's probably the most urgent issue on my desk. Then why can't he give a definitive answer on what they're going to do? I know he's new to the job, you know, he's only been in a couple of days, but he was the shadow secretary before that for quite a few months. So he's across this. He knows exactly how crucial this is and how pressing an issue it is.
Well, absolutely. He said when he was speaking yesterday to the press in Belfast City Centre that really the Casement Park issue is now in extra time, to use a football pun. And so therefore he knows that this is one of the most pressing issues that he will have on his desk as Northern Ireland Secretary. I think what did come across in his answer to Kelly Bonner and to the other reporters yesterday was that he really does know his brief. He does know what the issues are. He knows how much Casement Park had previously been estimated to cost. And I suppose the new piece of information that we got yesterday is that he says that today he'll get a final briefing as to what the level of cost is now, what the projected cost of Casement Park is now from his officials. So really that will be a crucial briefing that he says he's going to get today, which will give him some level of information that will allow him to go forward and decide what to do next. I think one thing that still isn't clear from the UK government around all of this is whether they will provide funding to Casement Park in any respect. So would they only be providing funding for Casement Park if it was linked to the Euros bid? But if that bid falls away and the Euros moves on without Belfast being involved, there's still a question mark as to whether a UK government would actually commit to giving funding to Casement Park if Casement wasn't part of that Euros bid. So there's still plenty of questions around what the new Secretary of State is going to do to try and handle this issue.
And again, it all does bottle down to money. And straight away, somebody on the text here, Peter, good morning to you, saying, you know, we're back to where we started. Money, 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 and they have none. And going by what Hilary Benn said at the weekend, it seems the mood music around Labour is around, well, Stormont needs to paddle their own canoe to a certain extent. They need to start revenue raising. They need to start increasing their own income and looking at how they spend it.
Well, absolutely. In that respect, there hasn't been a change. Although the Labour Party had campaigned on a platform of change for the UK government, there hasn't been a change in terms of the language between Labour and Conservatives as part of this new government, because the Labour government is now saying that, well, yes, you know, we can have negotiations and discussions about future finances for Stormont, for the Northern Ireland Executive and for the devolved nations and the devolved regions. But at the same time, Hilary Benn was saying yesterday that the finances here need to be supported by some sort of revenue raising measures, that he said, he argued that in the past that the Northern Ireland Executive hasn't exactly been good at public funding raising itself, to raise funds itself through its own means, which it currently has. So I think that there will be a bit of a carrot and stick approach going forward as to whether or not the Northern Ireland Executive can secure further finances from the UK Treasury. And if there is going to be any further finances or any more stable funding in future beyond what it currently gets through the block grant, I think that there will be some conditions attached to that.
Brendan, any sign of anyone this morning? I think we're expecting to hear from Sir Keir Starmer at around 9:30. Would that be right?
I think it might be a bit later than that from the timings that we were given earlier. Well, he did arrive earlier, just before 8 a.m. He arrived at Stormont Castle, where he was greeted by the First Minister, Michelle O'Neill, and Deputy First Minister, Emma Littleton-Gelly. The Prime Minister was also joined by the Secretary of State, Hilary Benn, in that meeting. There was an exchange of pleasantries on the steps of Stormont Castle before they went inside and had a brief meeting, which lasted around 30 minutes, maybe slightly under 30 minutes. And then after that, he was whisked away up to Parliament buildings in the Stormont Estate, where he was greeted by the Assembly Speaker, the DUP's Edwin Poots, and was brought into Parliament buildings, shown around a bit. And I'm expecting that he will be meeting with some of the parties that are involved in the Northern Ireland Executive, the four-party executive that we have, as well as the opposition at the Assembly as well. And then after that point, I think we're expecting that he will speak to the press. Later on in the morning anyway, that he will have a word with the press. And I think, as was set out at the beginning, the message from this new Labour government, from this new Prime Minister, will be one of stability, of repairing relations on all fronts. And really, that's what very much this visit is about to Northern Ireland.
Brendan Hughes, I'm sure we will speak to you later. Thank you for the moment. And like I say, we will bring you the new Prime Minister, Sir Keir Starmer. We're expecting to hear from him within the hour, so stay tuned and we will bring that live to you here on the Stephen Nolan Show. Right now, though, let's speak to DUP MP Gregory Campbell. Good morning to you, sir. How are you?
Good morning, Holly. Right.
Have you managed to catch up on your sleep?
Yes, just about.
Just
two,
about.
Two or three days, and I think to recover from a 28-hour marathon, I think it was Thursday and Friday.
Yeah, it's unless you've done it either working as a journalist or as a politician. I mean, you literally cannot sleep. That's it.
And it's difficult. Yeah.
And a very important job to do, Gregory.
Yes, it's going to be important for all of us, those of us who won seats and those of us, even those parties and others who lost deposits. We're all going to have to put our shoulder to the wheel and try and ensure that people have a much better future. And part of that's today. We've got to emphasise, and we will be emphasising to both the Prime Minister and the Secretary of State, that there are two things. One is the additional resources that we require according to our need. That has been partially addressed in the recent past. We've been pressing for that for some time. And then how we spend those resources. That's going to be a big key question because, and I understand the government will be pressing us on that, because we have been putting more money into the health service, but outputs haven't improved. Waiting lists are longer rather than shorter. So we've got to address how we spend the extra money. But we've got to get it first and then spend it better.
Yeah, from what I've seen, from what Hilary Benn has said, it was almost sort of a reprimand, really, you know, in terms of what's been happening until now, that he's saying that essentially Stormont needs to have a long, hard look at itself, and it needs to not only just look at how it's spending the money, but also come up with new ways to raise money. And obviously with the DUP had been in there for a long time. How do you reflect on those comments? Do you agree?
Well, I understand, given the overall national picture in terms of the belt tightening that has had to be done and will have to be done in the future. But as I say, we press the issue about need, because we do have an additional need in Northern Ireland for a variety of reasons. And that has been addressed partially, although we think there's a bit more to go. And then I think our quid pro quo on our side is to say to government, yes, if we get the additional resources, we are committed to ensuring that additional spend, as well as the existing spend, is spent better. So if that means revising and reforming and reviewing how we spend the money, then we have to do that. We've got to spend it better and get better outcomes.
How do we get more income then?
Well, hopefully we will get some additional income from the government. But
he's saying it has to be done by Stormont.
Well, in terms of need, we've said that the block grant needs to be revised, and that should require an additional sum of money coming from Westminster. But that in itself won't be the answer.
No.
Because if you look at the health budget has been increasing incrementally over many years. It now gets more money than all the other departments put together. And now that's unsustainable. You can't keep on doing that if outcomes are getting worse, because people over time and even now are saying, well, what is the point of putting more money into the health service if things get worse? So we've got to get that multi-billion pound expenditure under control so that it is spent better and better outcomes ensue. And we can go back to the government and saying, we are cutting our cloth here. We need additional resources. And when we get them, we're going to show that we deploy them and use them responsibly and we get better outcomes. That's what we need to do. And that's what we've committed to doing.
I suppose the point I'm making is, you know, the DUP were the biggest party for such a long time. And some of this spending that he's referring to, the overspending and you know, not raising the right sort of revenues, that has to, the DUP has to take some responsibility for that.
Well, we did indicate and introduce some revisions whenever we had the health department, but we haven't had it for some time now. So I don't think anybody can shy away and say, no, we have no responsibility. I think we all have to say, yes, we bear some responsibility. But the important thing isn't looking back and seeing what was done wrong many, many years ago, or what was improved but not enough. What we have to say now is, how do we improve it here on in?
Because so how do we then?
People will be saying, well, I think that an onus will lie with the executive firstly, but primarily within the executive, with the health department and the health minister. If he and that department is getting more than 50% of the entire budget, and everyone else is getting about 48% of the budget between them, then the onus will be in the health department to say, this is how we plan to spend our money more effectively and produce better outcomes. That's the onus that's on the department. We heard commitments previously that would be done within weeks of the executive being restored, and it hasn't happened as yet, but it needs to happen now.
Also on the line, I have UUP leader Doug Beattie. Good morning to you, Doug.
Good morning.
What did you make then of Hilary Benn's comments? And again, I'm trying to read between the lines, because Hilary Benn, he's not new to Northern Ireland. He knows us very, very well. And he seems to think that the executive, that Stormont needs to do a little bit of work here, pick up the slack and try and not just look at how it's spending the money, but raise some revenue. And I just feel like I'm not getting to how that's going to happen. Any ideas?
Yeah, well, listen, it is a fundamental problem, but the starting point to all of this is that for many years we've been funded below need, and we have to remember we've been funded below need, and that's had a detrimental effect on public services right across the board, and particularly in regards to health. To be pointed on the question that you've raised is what do we do about revenue raising? You're absolutely right. We've tried to engage in that conversation just to talk about it. We've raised it on the floor of the Assembly. We've asked questions. We've raised it in the Executive. If we take, for example, water, everybody automatically goes to water charging. Mm-hmm. We're saying, look, you can mutualise water and try and do it in a different way and generate revenue that way. So we've put forward proposals, and we all have to look at how we're going to do this and not shy away from it, and not price ourselves out of the market here, because in some ways people shutting down that conversation are pricing us out of the market. But something Gregory said, and he's absolutely right, and we all have to take responsibility, because this didn't just happen now, this happened over mm-hmm. many years. We have to change the way we do business, and we have to change what we do within the health service. But to do that, we need investment to change. It's as simple as that. It can't go on year after year, but we haven't had a multi-year budget for God knows how long. We still don't have a programme for government. We're still not focusing our finances in a strategic outcome manner. But we do need to change. And all I'm saying with the health department is we need that investment in order to change.
What do you make of the result here in Northern Ireland, Doug? And particularly in terms of what's happened within the unionist vote. There's been a lot of reflection, I think, over the past few days. And I know that you have felt that there's a narrative being spun by the DUP.
Well, look, I think there's a narrative being spun by not just the DUP, but by many other people. And that is that unionism had a bad election. The reality is the DUP had a bad election. We all know what it's like to have a bad election, but this time around the DUP had a bad election. But we left Westminster with 8 MPs. We're going back to Westminster with 8 MPs. But the positive to that is we now have a range of unionist voices, so that people can see that there's something more than what the DUP offered over this last number of years. There's other people who can now stand up and say, here is a different view of how we can do this. So for me, it's quite positive in many respects. I think unionism has a tendency to do itself down, and many commentators have a tendency to do it down as well. But at the end of the day, we left with 8, we're going back with 8, but it's just a different split. And I'm really quite impressed with the result that Robin Swan got, and I'm looking forward to him going there. But if I look further afield, if I look to East Antrim, where our representative there, John Stewart, increased his share of the vote by 7.5%. You know, or if I look to Robbie Butler, who's had the best result in Lagan Valley in 20 years, you know, things are certainly shifting. And I think we need to look at the positives and stop focusing on the negatives.
Well, I suppose you've spelled out some of the positives from your point of view there. But just to go back, and we've lost Gregory Campbell for the moment. But to go to what Gavin Robinson, the DUP leader, has said, he says, while unionism went into this election with 8 seats and comes out with 8 seats, we can never see a situation where pro-union voters are so divided that seats are lost to those who will not promote the union. Is that the situation that we are currently in, where we've got Gavin Robinson saying that there is an issue for unionist unity, as he calls it? Is that the situation Northern Ireland is in now?
Look, we have to look at this, and I'm willing to speak to everybody in regards to this to come up with a better way of doing it. But I think some people need to show a degree of humility in regards to this. There are certainly seats that were lost that didn't have to be lost. And I look to Lagan Valley, because The DUP were told where the issue was going to be, and there was a Jeffrey Donaldson effect in suppressing that vote that came out for the DUP. They were told that was going to be the case. In fact, they were told it was probably best not to run in Lagan Valley, and we would have retained that seat for a unionist. But look, that's their right to run, and we've never expected anybody to stand down in any shape or form. But look, people need to take responsibility for what went wrong. I'm quite happy.
So you do think
willing.
Something went wrong?
Well, I think in some areas it did go wrong, but in many areas it went right. We've got a pro union MP now in North Down. That's a positive. We lost out in Lagan Valley, so that's a negative. There's many positives and there's many negatives there. But look, I want to focus on what is the positive for unionism. And look, we need to stop doing ourselves down here in many ways.
Looking ahead, and can I bring in Owen Tennyson, who's on the line as well? Good morning to you, Alliance MLA Owen Tennyson. How are you today?
Good morning, Holly. I'm good. I've had a night's sleep.
And Doug, I understand you have to go and meet with the Prime Minister now, so I'm going to let you go. What's the first thing?
Thank you.
Doug, just before you go, what's the first thing that you want to say to Sir Keir Starmer?
Well, I'm going to say to the Prime Minister that he needs to prioritise cohesion of the union. That is the cohesion of the four nations of the United Kingdom, because that's the important bit here. We should all be UK-wide unionists, I certainly am. So cohesion within the United Kingdom. But then I'm going to focus on public services and particularly health. And that's why I'm bringing Mike Nesbitt with me and Robin Swan.
Doug, thank you very much. Owen, good morning to you. Just, I'm sure you were listening to Doug there. And the first thing he's going to speak to Sir Keir Starmer about is cohesion of the union. What's the priority for you?
Well, our priority, Holly, is about stability at the Assembly. And when I talk about stability, I mean two things. First of all, our financial stability, but also our political stability, because we know that those two things have been the biggest impediment to the Assembly making progress and delivering for the people of Northern Ireland over the past 10 years. We know that for a period of time we have been funded below relative need. That has had a scarring impact on our public services, and so there is a need to deliver a more sustainable funding package. But we also know that vetoes at Stormont have either ended up in a place where we have no government whatsoever, or have prevented some of the key decisions that need to be taken about transformation of public services. And so if we are going to make the progress that is needed, you know, 8 years on from the Bangor report into the health service, for example, we need to have the confidence that, first of all, the institutions will be there, but also that the institutions will be able to withstand some very difficult decisions. And so we will want to discuss our proposals in terms of how we would reform the institutions to copper fasten them and ensure that no single party can pull them down again in the future.
But you have been, you know, the Alliance certainly has played a huge role over the past few years, and all this talk of reform and things that need to change and improve spending, improve revenue. Why wait till now? Why is it taking so long to have any changes on this front? I mean, again, we've had these conversations on the show before.
Yeah, and we haven't waited until now, Holly. I mean, Alliance has always taken transformation of public services really seriously. So if you go back to when Stephen Farry was Minister for Employment and Learning, he was talking about serious reform in terms of teacher training. David Ford was talking about very serious judicial reforms, but those decisions were either vetoed by other parties or subsequently reversed. And so we have a bizarre situation where the system at Stormont actually incentivizes this kind of populism and makes consensus really difficult to reach, because people know if they don't get their own way, they can take the ball and walk off the pitch. And what we're saying is we need to lay the foundations and create the environment in which these difficult decisions can be made in a more collegiate way. And that starts with changing how the Assembly functions. It starts with dealing with things like cross-community votes and vetoes, both at the Executive but at the Assembly more broadly. And I think that will enable the Executive to make progress in some of these areas, because we recognise there are a number of levers which have to be pulled here. I think getting our funding formula right is the biggest aspect of this. That is the main determinant of the state of our public finances. But there are also conversations that we need to have in terms of delivering services differently, because we know the trajectory that we're on in some departments isn't good enough. And I mean, I have been raising questions in the Assembly since it was restored to the Infrastructure Minister in terms of the governance arrangements around water. We've been raising questions around the Education Minister's refusal to commission a review of the cost of provision within that sector. So as a party, we are serious about this. And I guess it's important that we grasp this opportunity to get on the same page with other executive parties and actually start to make progress in this area, because I think that's what people expect.
Well, it might be too late, certainly for some of you. Stephen Farry, for example. I mean, people have voted and they've made a decision, and I imagine partially in response to how the Alliance has performed over the past few years, your manifesto, and it's the support has gone down. How do you reflect on your performance?
Yeah, well, look, it's a bittersweet election in some respects, Holly. I mean, if you take a step back and look at the picture across Northern Ireland as a whole, I mean, we scored our second best share of the vote in a Westminster election in the party's history. And so there have been really strong performances in some constituencies, and there have been many positives. But of course, the performance in North Down was a huge disappointment. And I think we came up against a very particular set of circumstances in that constituency. Obviously, in 2019, we had a perfect storm with Brexit and the Assembly being down. And this time we faced a challenge from Alex Easton, who I congratulate on his win. And Alex, I think, very successfully branded himself as an independent, despite the fact we know he was effectively running on a joint DUP-TUV reform ticket. Mm. And so that posed a real communications challenge to us as a political party in terms of how we fought that election against an independent candidate. We know that North Down is a constituency that likes its mavericks that's been represented by independents before. And so, of course, we have to take time to reflect on all of that. But I have no doubt that we will be back. But in terms of Stephen, I mean, my overriding emotion is one of pride, because I actually think Stephen has contributed more than any sole voice at Westminster in terms of Northern Ireland. If you look at challenges around Brexit, Stephen was the first MP to talk about a veterinary agreement. That is now Labour policy and is likely to be implemented under this government. On our public finances, Stephen was the first MP to call for a financial package. We have got to a point where some of those issues have now been partially addressed. We've delivered significant additional investment in public services and public sector pay.
But you said this doesn't seem to have cut through to the electorate, though, with this mixed bag of results.
And that's what we have to reflect on, Holly. We have to reflect in terms of how we communicate that strong record, and how we compete with independent voices, which is a very different ballgame, I guess, than when you're competing against other political parties. So, look, like every other party, we will go away, we will take stock, we will reflect on the constituencies that we've had strong performances and those constituencies where we've had disappointments. But certainly from my perspective, looking at the results, there are a number of places like East Antrim where I think we're in a very strong position to challenge for seats in the future. And I think if you look towards future Assembly and Council elections, there are clearly further opportunities for growth. So I think there has been a relatively strong endorsement of the Alliance Party in this election, and the messages that we were putting out in terms of progressive, positive, united community politics focused on those issues that affect all of our constituents. And I think, look, whilst there have been disappointments, we can certainly take hope in that for the future.
So talking about the future, but for the right now, we do know that Stephen Farry won't be taking Saoirse Eastwood's seat in Stormont. Do we know who will?
We don't, because there's a party process underway. I mean, I think applications are open internally within the party. There will be a role for the association in terms of selecting the best candidate, I guess, for that role. And so hopefully this week we should have news in terms of who has been successful and who has been selected by the party. We always, in the Alliance Party, we go through a very rigorous process and a fair process. So you'll understand, Holly, I wouldn't want to prejudice that.
Absolutely. And I'm not sure what you can comment on, say, on Stephen Farry's future. I know he has said he's committed to his vision and values and the best future for Northern Ireland, as he put it. What is next for Mr. Farry?
Well, I think that's a question for Stephen, Holly. I mean, obviously, Stephen will want to take time now with his family to reflect in terms of what comes next. But look, there will always be a place for Stephen within the Alliance family and in whatever form he wishes, if he wishes. But I think after the past number of days, he'll want to take some time, first of all, I think, to recuperate and reflect and think about what comes next.
Understood. Owen Tennyson, for the moment, thank you very much. We are going to take some calls on this straight after your BBC News. As the dust settles on the general election, all seems like weeks ago now. It was only a matter of days, like a very strange dream. But here we are, the first Monday. What is in the inbox? Sir Keir Starmer is right here in Northern Ireland. Do you have a question, a statement, something that you want to tell this new government? 03030 80 55 55. Let's speak to Gareth, who's in Kirkcubbon. Good morning to you, Gareth.
Good morning, Holly. Well, I'm just thinking about the narrative of Sir Keir Starmer, and it is that he is going to sort of be equally balanced with all the different parts of the UK, and obviously that includes Northern Ireland, and surely that should affect his decision on Casement Park as well, especially whenever he has this tournament coming up in 2028, which is basically the equivalent to the London 2012 Olympics for the previous administration, who was in coalition with the Lib Dems at the same time.
Do you think he sees it like that?
Well, he ought to, because it will be a feel-good project, both for Northern Ireland and also for the rest of the UK. And let's have a very quick look at the numbers. If the Irish government is contributing 40 or 50 million, that means that the UK government surely must be contributing at least 100 million anyway. Otherwise, they would look like rather poor partners. So when we bear that in mind, we really only are talking about another 70 or 80 million pounds in order to complete this project. So why on earth would the Prime Minister not provide those funds for this UK-wide tournament, which is going to give the UK and Ireland a feel-good factor as he nears the end of his first term, Holly? It makes absolutely no sense whatsoever for them not to go the extra mile to provide this project for Casement Park and for Northern Ireland. And my final point to clinch it really is that we have already been told by the experts that the stadium would bring in £100 million for Belfast. So therefore, that extra 70 or 80 million pounds would be paid for anyway by the extra business that Belfast would have, Holly. So if his aides are listening this morning, surely they ought to bear that in mind. And they ought to actually think about the medium-term benefits of this for Belfast, for Northern Ireland, and actually for their own government as well.
I choose to believe that they're all listening intently to this, Gareth. And now, I don't want this to become a Casement phone-in. We've done this to death. This is obviously on the reaction now, isn't it, in terms of what Labour, how they're dealing with it. What did you make of Hilary Benn's comments? And I made the point earlier on that, you know, he's new in the job, understandably. He's only been the Northern Ireland Secretary a matter of days, but he was the Shadow Secretary before that. So he gets it. He understands. He knows how pressing this issue is. He's probably heard you on before, Gareth, talking about it. And yet we still haven't sort of got a definitive answer. You know, I feel like that's the point here, that if this is the most pressing issue in his inbox, he will know the people in Belfast, that's the first thing that they're going to ask him. And should it be the first thing they're going to ask him?
It's a wee bit like them turning around and saying, we're not going to hold the London 2012 Olympics because of 70 or 80 million pounds, because that's what it comes down to. If the government isn't already going to contribute 100 million pounds, then they really do look like very poor partners compared to the Irish government. So therefore, if we're assuming that that money is there for it, we are only talking about an extra 70 or 80 million pounds, Holly.
I do love, Gareth, how you talk about only 70 or 80 million pounds. I love the confidence in that. Gareth, thank you for your comments on that this morning. Let's speak to Fred in Lisburn. Good morning to you, Fred. How are you?
Good morning, Holly. Welcome back to the seat.
It's lovely to be back.
I'll tell you what it is. I'm going from a different angle here. Mm. The first thing is, Sinn Féin went and met the Prime Minister, had a phone call with the Prime Minister. They're meeting them today. And here's my point. They're saying the first thing on their inbox is self-determination. Well, I'm sorry. Self-determination means being able to take hard choices, like raising your own funds, doing the best for the country as a whole. How can they do it when they don't take their seats in Parliament? Number one. Number two, they turn around and say their party members get their party gets the full wage, but their members, MPs, get a wage within that. Sinn Féin are very quick to hold back and tell people what that wage is. How much is the new MP for Manus out your own getting?
But people who voted know all of that.
No, you don't know all of that, Holly. That's the thing.
It's brand new information to them.
You know you're not going to take your seats.
Yeah, they do.
But here's the thing, okay? You vote for them on that policy.
Mm-hmm.
They get elected in that area. I vote against them in that area. Who's representing me?
And that, in a nutshell, Fred,
all of the community, all of the voters, the ones that we do not class to be represented as the non-voters, because they have their choice whether to vote or not, Holly. It is the choice.
Isn't it how democracy works? That is the election.
No,
that is how.
Well, it is, but at the end of the day, come democracy, come rights, there's also responsibility. You can't have your rights and demand things if you don't stand up and say, look, well, I did take my vote. I did do this, or I did do that.
Do you know, it's a really interesting point, Fred, actually, and we are going to be talking about this later in the programme, and it's about voter turnout. So we're going to be talking about those people who did not vote.
They had no say.
Fred, thank you very much for your call. Let's speak now to Kevin Marr, who is a commentator. Good morning to you, Kevin, and also former Labour Party special advisor. That was the words I was scrambling about in the dark there for, Kevin. How are you?
Very well, very well. How are you?
I'm good. I do enjoy a Monday after an election, I have to say. How are you reflecting on the result now? I'm sure you're a happy man.
It's a bit like, it feels a little bit like the origins of the universe, that the debris is scattered across the political solar system in Westminster at the moment. I mean, there's just a huge, it's a huge inflection point in British politics. Lots and lots of changes, lots of things happen, which will take a while for people to work out what they actually mean, I think. The rise of reform, you know, the fact that, you know, that Labour's got a huge, huge majority, but not on a huge share of the vote. And that's a bit of a conundrum as well. So there's a lot of things still to work out about what this all means. And it's going to take a while to do that, I think.
Yeah, it's a lot to unpack. And it's funny, we're seeing that with France overnight, you know, when the vote ends up being kind of thinly spread, and we just had a caller on there kind of complaining, saying, you know, I'm in a constituency essentially where I didn't vote for the person who now has won, who represents me. But that's democracy. That's how it works.
That's how our system works. And it's trying to divine what the message is from the electorate. And there's no single message. I think if you're trying to sum up what's just happened in the British general election, it's just, we want the Tories out. And I think that's kind of spun off in all kinds of different directions. It's gone to Labour, clearly. They've got a big majority. But it's gone to the Liberal Democrats, who had a very, very good result. It's gone to Reform, which, as I say, got 4 million votes, which is you know, unprecedented, really, for a party that effectively didn't even exist at the time of this long run into our general election process as well. So there's lots of messages in there, and you know, trying to pull out what that all means and how people feel they've got a mandate is going to be, I think, a work in progress.
Yeah, it's a lot of work in progress. And funny, you touched on, you know, we mentioned it there, the voter turnout and how essentially we've got Labour who've been elected, and that when you start to go through the figures in terms of how many people voted, and it's actually one of the lowest numbers in years, which surprised me actually, because so much of the campaign was about change. There was this feeling in the build up that people were going to, you know, come out in their numbers to vote, that people wanted to have their say, but they didn't.
There's obviously a lot of people cheesed off for any number of reasons who don't think voting actually makes much difference, and that should concern everybody. That's no good for anybody. I mean, you know, it's second lowest turnout since, I think, 1885. So it's, you know, there's a real kind of sting in the tail here, where yes, it's a change election, we've changed government, and this is you know, one of the very rare moments in Labour Party history where the Labour Party wins big. It's only happened really on two previous occasions in 1945, the last time there was a July election, so perhaps there's a lesson there. Yeah. And of course, Tony Blair's election victory in 1997. So you know, for Labour people, it's, you know, they've obviously probably had a very good weekend and a bit bleary eyed this morning as they return to Westminster in unprecedented numbers. But there's going to be no complacency there, because, as I say, what does this election result actually mean? Well, it means, first of all, that, as you say, that, you know, nearly 4 out of 10 voters didn't even bother participating. And then, of course, you know, there was a kind of an overwhelming mood that perhaps there needed to be a change of government in the country. But that, as I say, has spun off in lots of different directions. So there's lots of threads to this. Keir Starmer will tread very cautiously. And you know, there won't be very much hubris, and there won't be very much hullabaloo. He'll just get on with the job quite quietly and quickly and try and make some difference and implement his manifesto.
And regardless of where your support lies, I suppose it's a new chapter, certainly, after everything that's happened with Brexit and those negotiations. And in terms of relationships between London and Dublin specifically, Simon Harris certainly sees this election as how he's described it, as a new era in relations for Dublin and Westminster.
Well, I mean, the buzz phrase of the age is reset. Dublin's very keen on that, and you know, Keir Starmer and his team are very keen on that as well. There's a sense that this relationship, this very important relationship, and what can be, you know, a difficult relationship to manage between London and Dublin, you know, kind of ended up in a very bad state of disrepair, if I can put it like that, particularly under Boris Johnson. And because of the Brexit process and the implications on the island of Ireland with the border and all the rest of it. So I think that there's a general relief, probably, I suspect, in Dublin and in Belfast, but also in London as well, that this can be kind of put behind everybody and kind of get things back on an even keel. Because it's so obviously so important, because London and Dublin are the co-guarantors of the Good Friday Agreement, that they've got to get on to some degree. There can be differences and all the rest of it, but I think we're going to see a very big emphasis on a joint front, which we've not seen really for several years now.
Professor Deirdre Heenan is on the line. Good morning to you.
Good morning, Holly.
How are you feeling? I can imagine it's been quite a weekend for you. You've been very busy. How do you feel this Monday morning, reflecting on this? So Keir Starmer is in Belfast right now. We're expecting to hear from him within the next hour or so. What do you expect to be the first thing out of his mouth?
Well, I think this morning I would reflect that we're hopeful. There's a renewal of hope, hopefully a renewal of trust. As Kevin has said, Sir Keir Starmer has stated that he wants to reset relationships with the devolved nations. And that's really important, because there's a feeling that we have been forgotten about at the end of a very long list. And the relationship, which is very important, has been allowed to wither in the vine. Northern Ireland has some serious problems, which you don't need me to rehearse. We talk about them every day of the week. But most particularly, our public services are in disarray. The National Health Service here has serious problems, not least with underperformance. We have economic weaknesses, skills gap, low productivity, and we've been talking about educational underachievement for two decades. And these issues contribute to low public confidence and perhaps can explain a low turnout in terms of the election. So I think Keir Starmer has to come along and say that he recognises these problems and he has a plan to deal with them. COVID inquiry has cast governance here in a very poor light, and people have lost trust in our devolved institutions and indeed Westminster to deliver for us. So we've had the election, we've had our restoring of local institutions. Now it's time to say, how are they going to make a real difference to people's lives here?
Yeah, and locally, the result here, how do you reflect on that? You made some comments in the Irish News today, reflecting on the fact that there is no such thing as a safe unionist seat.
Well, I suppose we've been long used to looking at particular seats across Northern Ireland and saying that's a safe unionist seat. We don't need to discuss it. And when we were discussing the election or reviewing what might happen, there were a number of seats that weren't even discussed. It was just passed over as, we know this is a fait accompli. What we are seeing now is change, people wanting change and people demanding that their lives are made different. And I think that then becomes a very different discussion. Of course, we've had the inevitable discussions about unionist unity, why there are so many unionist parties, unionist realignment, but we've been here before. And the big existential question is, unity about what? We have to move on from the idea of only we get all clubbed together, then we could keep those ones out. People are not responding to that anymore. They want to see progressive politics. They want to see people saying, this is what we can now offer you for the future. The ground which unionism stands on is shrinking, so they have to produce a compelling vision that says, this is what it could be like in the future, not this old circle of wagons and we'll all be safe. I think climate change, the economic situation here, and most particularly from my perspective, what has happened in the health service means that people are languishing and dying on waiting lists, and they're much less interested in the constitutional issues, and they want to know, how can this be addressed? It is a difficult one for Labour, because of course many of these issues are fully devolved, and that means it would be a delicate process for them to say, how can we assist without being seen to be interfering? And perhaps they might say, yes, we recognise that there's a financial difficulty here, but we simply are not going to be in the business of giving you more money to keep doing the same thing and have the same outcomes. So what we might want to work with you is to produce some sort of long-term plan or strategy that says we can actually transform services and transform people's lives.
So just to pick up there on, you know, you talk about the various unionist parties that you mentioned and this idea of circling the wagons. And I imagine that somebody who doesn't believe in circling the wagons would be Ron McDowell of the TUV. Good morning to you.
Good morning.
A great election result for Jim Allister, of course. When you hear a lot of the analysis over the last couple of days, this idea of splitting the vote within unionism, how do you reflect upon that now?
We didn't set out our stall at the start of this election to fight against other unionists. And that was something that I think media and other unionist parties allowed to be propagated. We set out to gain as many votes as we could for the TUV manifesto. We fought out to win votes for what we stand for. And that's why TUV got votes this time. It wasn't because we were standing against anyone. Mm. Others paid the price for decisions that they made during their tenure of office. And we won votes based on our strong stance.
I appreciate what you're saying. And a lot of people will. A lot of people did vote. But you will have known that that's what that was going to be a result of that. That people would vote for you instead of the DUP or the UUP, whoever it might be. It was inevitable that it's going to split the vote. That's just how it works. In the same way we saw, you know, between a lot of previous Conservative supporters voted Reform in this, and it happened in the same way.
And I think that in hindsight, looking back at the election, unionism hasn't suffered, but it has also delivered a strong message. So we now have a more diverse unionism represented at Westminster. We have an Ulster Unionist Party MP, we have a TUV MP, we have an Independent Unionist MP.
What does diverse unionism look like?
Well, it looks like what you've got now is different voices at the table articulating their cause. And I think the very negative campaign that was run by the DUP saying that only one unionist party can win, and their little graphics that they had on all their election literature pointing to the TUV saying can't win, it was a negative campaign. But we stood on truth and honesty. It resonated with people. We've got our MP and we've got our voice, and we are very satisfied with the election results.
And is there a different type of unionist now, do you feel?
I think the clue to TUV's in the name. We're traditional unionists. We believe in full equal citizenship with the UK. And we're really, really pleased that we're going to have now the strongest unionist voice in Westminster, calling out the Prime Minister if and when he gets the opportunity. Something that we never had before this election. And all of those election pledges we made, we're going to try and honour them.
What do you make of the relationship now with Reform? Because it all got a bit messy there, didn't it? Because Reform were sort of part of the TUV. There's talk of Jim taking the whip within Reform. But then Nigel Farage went and supported Ian Paisley. How are relations there?
Well, that was obviously one of the big issues that was played out before the election. We were strong. We honoured our commitments with Reform, and the Reform Party have treated us exceptionally well. As a party, they have been great with us. They've been good for
really?
Us. Yes, and we've been net gainers out of that. They've come over, campaigned for us. They've helped us financially, and they've helped us with our platform.
Is supporting your rival treating you well?
So that was Nigel Farage, who has come
in
as a maverick. That's right. And he won. And as a maverick, he supported two of his friends. And Jim has flew over to London this morning. And you and I both, Holly, would probably love to be a fly on the wall for that first conversation between Jim and Nigel Farage.
Can I ask, of course, as well, Jim's going to be replaced at Stormont. Are you going to be that replacement?
I don't know. The conversation hasn't been had with any of us.
It's not?
No, not yet. It's an internal matter. And we haven't got long. But what I would say about that is the TUV are a tightly knit unit. We're really, really close. It's one of our strengths is the fraternity between our members. So no matter who gets that seat, it's going to have the support of every single person.
Do you want it?
It's not my decision to make.
You don't know if you want it or not. That is your decision.
I can think of candidates that I would love to see come forward and put their name into the hat, who's not Ron McDowell,
but you'd take it if you were asked.
Have to wait and see. We're all here to serve as best we can, but I would like to see other people putting their name forward.
All right, okay. None the wiser then. We'll wait and see. Ron McDowell of the TUV, thanks very much for your time. We'll be back with more on this straight after your BBC News. A huge day with the Prime Minister in the country today, the newly elected Prime Minister, Sir Keir Starmer, who is meeting the First and Deputy First Ministers at Stormont Castle on what is his first visit to Northern Ireland as Prime Minister. We're seeing footage on BBC News at the moment. The press conferences are well underway. We are expecting to hear from Sir Keir Starmer within the next hour, we hope, and we'll bring that to you if and when it happens. I did accidentally just break the studio trying to get the press conference onto the TV screens here. I managed to get the DUP leader, Gavin Robinson, about 3 foot high in the screens behind me. So thank you very much to Gareth and the team for fixing that. Let's get some calls on this now. 030 30 80 55 55. Good morning, Dan. How are you this morning? How is sunny Lisburn, Dan?
How you doing there, Holly? Holly, the first thing Labour wants to do whenever they come here is to start to organise a Labour Party where you can vote for in Northern Ireland.
Oh.
Yes, absolutely.
Do you know, this is a really interesting point, Dan, because I was speaking, obviously work over in England quite a lot, and speaking to some of my colleagues there who were, well, they're not politically minded, but they were almost surprised that that's not who we vote for over here. A lot of people actually assume that we just have which we do have representation from the Conservatives and parts of Labour, but that's, you know, that we obviously have our own political system here. And yeah, it actually surprised them, that we don't have that. We've got our own stuff going on.
Well, Mr. Starmer says he's a unionist. He says he wanted to promote the four countries in the United Kingdom. How can he do that if there's no Labour Party here? Because they have a sister party, which is the SDLP. And there's no way I can vote for a party when their leader comes out and says that Northern Ireland's a basket case. Because it's certainly not.
Who are you referring to with that?
Pardon?
Who are you referring to?
Colm Eastwood. I mean, Northern Ireland is not a basket case. There's not a week that the public sector might be underperforming. That is truly, we all know that. But the private sector, there's not a week goes by, Holly, that one of our firms is not winning some sort of award on a national basis, not on a Northern Ireland basis. They're winning awards in the fifth biggest economy in the world. And you should read the newsletter. Two of our firms won awards for being out of 10 in a class of manufacturers and businesses that compete with the rest of the world.
Dan, you know I don't sit in this seat quite as often, so you scared me there with your comments about Colm Eastwood. I don't know if he has said that.
He has said it. They said it.
So I couldn't possibly stand that up. And you know that, Dan. You know that, Dan. Let's speak now to Brian in Lisburn. Dan, thanks for your call there. Brian in Enniskillen. How are you, Brian?
Good morning, Holly. I'm all the better for hearing your voice on a Monday morning.
It's lovely to be back. You're all keeping me on my toes this morning anyway. And as I said at the start of the show, I do like a Monday after an election. It's good. It's kind of like the cleanup operation. I'm here with my rubber gloves in.
Well, fair play to you. You can come with me with the garden later on. That's for sure.
I don't think if you saw my garden, you wouldn't want me anywhere near it. Trust me. Yes. Brian, what have you made about it then? And you know, what's the top of the agenda then for Keir Starmer in Northern Ireland?
Well, firstly, I think you have enough to do at your own palatial estate. Don't worry about mine. Right. Well, listen, the first thing, can I just make one? I will answer your question. Holly, I could spend the whole of your programme trying to explain things that are up the left here, in a sense. But I'm glad your previous caller has given me extra faith yet again in the Windsor framework that these companies and manufacturing firms are doing so well. Happy days, which I believe is correct. Right. Doug Beattie, for example, I'll tell you why the UUP failed in Fermanagh, South Tyrone, was due to the fact Doug happened to say it to you. He asked him what he was going to say to Keir Starmer. First of all, he said, protecting the union. Oh, yes. And by the way, then healthcare. That should have been the other way around. And that's what's happened in Fermanagh here in Tyrone. My clients, Holly, are petrified of getting sick. They're not interested at this moment in time in protecting the union, nor also on a local level. On the back of the pamphlet from the UUP was getting rid of the protocol and Windsor framework type scenario, and also protecting veterans, looking after veterans. What the hell about the rest of us? So that's the UUP button in their box. What I would say to Keir Starmer and the Home Secretary, or sorry, Secretary of State, is this. Casement Park is what your programme actually started with, which was no surprise to me, is that if the GAA ups their financial offer, I don't suspect that the Labour Party will stand in the way of Casement Park going ahead. So that's that bagged and tagged.
Yeah, because he did sort of say, didn't he, Hilary Benn? He was kind of, one way or another, to quote the song, that's what he said. It will happen one way or another.
That's the bottom line. And from a business perspective, that to me is business language. One way or another, it'll happen. So if you're not one of the main investors, who will be the main benefactor, then you'll be just told to walk away and wise up. So that's that bagged. The other thing is that really I would speak to both the Secretary of State and Keir Starmer on is this. I would say they would be horrified to see that we have actually got six trusts running 1.9 million people's welfare and health. And I think that should be reduced to one, Holly.
Brian, I do always enjoy your calls because you're always so succinct. But unfortunately, today we don't have time to go through all the issues today.
But that's my main priority, no, Holly. That's the main one.
You've made some really interesting points, and that's, you know, I'm keen to hear from people in reaction to that 0-30-30-80-55-55, because a lot of what we've talked about today, is it important to you? You know, we've focused so much about Casement Park. You know, the idea of the unionist vote being split, border polls. What's, you know, and healthcare has been mentioned, but not actually as much as the rest of those. What's important to you? 0-30-30-80-55-55. Maybe you don't care about any of it. Maybe you've just been watching the football. Maybe you've just wanted to switch all the election coverage off and just focus on the Euros, which is probably what our next guest has been doing, because we're into the semi-finals. We're into the business end of it. England still thinks it's coming home. Yeah, they're through to the semi-finals after what was, let's be honest though, a pretty unconvincing performance before a penalty shootout win over Switzerland.
Here we go again. England in a major tournament, and it's going to penalties. Akanji focused. Saved by Jordan Pickford! Trent takes the net off! England go through! Another penalty shootout is won at a major tournament!
Oh, I was watching. Now, let's speak to Chief Football Writer at The Independent, Miguel Delaney. Good morning to you. How are you?
Good morning. Not too bad, not too bad.
How have you been enjoying this tournament? Because I was chatting to it with a friend of mine. I was over in London, and they are an England fan, and they said, oh, you know, what do you make of? And he actually ended up agreeing with me to a certain extent that he feels like, you know, he's happy with the result, but he's not a very happy England fan. So it's been a bit of a mixed bag.
Yeah, there's been a lot swirling around it. I mean, I suppose ultimately the main issue is England haven't put in, you'd say, really a single convincing performance yet. In fact, it says a lot that when we talk, even when we talk to Southgate, you're looking at kind of little spells in games where they looked a bit better, but they still haven't actually looked good. Now, despite that, they're in the semi-finals. They probably should fancy beating what is a moderate Dutch side, certainly not as good as the Dutch sides that England would have faced in the past, at least 1996. And then suddenly you're in a final and potentially 90 minutes from glory. Now, that's probably stepping ahead, but even now they're 180 minutes from glory. They've got a great chance. And yet, obviously, the kind of the hope that comes from being so close to it isn't really quite matched by, I suppose, the conviction or, sorry, the feeling around how the team is playing. But, of course, the one thing to say in all this, you know, having covered tournaments now myself for like almost 20 years, obviously watched it a lot longer, we have seen a lot of other countries get through competitions in this way. I mean, the classic used to be the Germans, who would have always just find a way, winning on penalties. France have become a bit like that in terms of finding their way through.
And but I'll be honest, I'd rather watch France. Or Germany.
I think actually that's a bit debatable. I've been to a few French games this tournament and they've been dismal. And they're one of the French are the lowest scoring team goal per game to ever reach a European semi-final.
But in terms of, I just find England at the minute, and I don't want to get too technical here, but I just find them quite dull to watch. Even, you know, there's no. And they have these individual players that when you watch them at club level are brilliant, but for some reason when they're in the England setup, they're so dull. What, I just can't work it out. I don't think anyone can.
I mean, that is a long-running issue. I think some of it is basically Southgate's approach to this tournament. Now, he would always say he wants to play quicker, he wants to play a different way, but this goes back to when he first got the job. He basically looked at what wins tournaments and kind of him and his staff formed this sort of Bible of how you approach it. And one of the main influences was Portugal in 2016, and France in 2018, and still the French manager Didier Deschamps. Mm. And this is based on basically a strong core and then kind of control. There are a few issues probably why they haven't clicked even as much as previous tournaments. I think the makeup of the squad, how he's changed it, just the feel of the group as well. And I suppose ultimately this is the main issue with England. On one side you see so many star names that are good for their team, are good for their club team, and then they go out and produce... I mean, again, and I think they've been like, I do think they're really, really fortunate to have got this far.
Yeah,
the Swiss could have knocked them out in the last 5 minutes of extra time. But equally, you can speak to a certain resilience there.
And funny, because I kept using the comparison to the Rugby World Cup, where it was actually very similar, where they just seemed to have this very, and I don't want to say an easy route because that puts down the other teams, but it just seemed to be they just kind of, through almost sheer luck, and they got to the semi-finals in that situation as well. So, you know, the Netherlands next. Are they going to end up in the final?
Yeah, I think they will. Although this game, I think it's a more evenly matched game than the Swiss game. Now, to be fair, everyone's got into the Swiss game thinking the Swiss would knock them out. I think the Swiss played England a lot of respect. But actually, the most meaningful moment of the tournament might actually have been when Germany scored a last-minute equaliser against Switzerland. You mentioned there about the ease of the draw. Had Germany not scored that, it would have been the hosts that England played in the quarterfinal rather than Switzerland. And it changes a lot, but they are on the more forgiving side of the draw, you'd say. And even Gary Neville said it on his podcast. He didn't want to put down our teams. He didn't want to kind of talk about past teams. But they would have killed for a Switzerland and then this Dutch as opposed to Argentina. Now, the flip side to that, of course, is England did top their group, whereas a few of the previous Golden Generation teams didn't.
I like that term. I might steal that from you. The forgiving teams. That's probably the politest way to put that. But whenever I watched Spain Germany, to me that felt like it should have been the final. We always get that, you know, where you go, this should have been it. It's been one of the best games so far. I just can't imagine a situation where you've got Spain and England, and that being a tight match. Let's say that's the final. That's, you know, if that's where we're headed with this.
If it was, I'm going to both semis, which is just shortly off to Munich after this for the Spain-France game, and I think France could actually make that a bit of a less watchable Spanish game. And I think if it is England to play Spain, that might be the same. And that's the thing, like as good as Spain have been, it's all dependent on the opposition as well and how they approach them, which I imagine is going to be to dig in. And if England do play Spain, I'd expect a similar approach. Then, of course, if it's England, France, if England do beat Holland, of course, that's a massive caveat there. We might see something similar to the quarterfinals in Qatar in 2022 when France beat them. And that's why I suppose maybe if it's France, if England do get there, there will be an element of kind of symbolism and kind of symmetry to it all, given France have been, they won Southgate's first tournament in 2018. They've been the kind of team they measured themselves at the most. They knocked them out of the last tournament. But obviously, there's still a long way to go. Yeah, and the Dutch shouldn't be discounted. Koeman's he's not an outstanding Dutch manager, but he is a very clever manager relative to this tournament.
Who's going to win it?
I want to say Spain because they do play, I think, the best style of the four teams left.
Yeah.
I'm thinking France, though, I have to say.
Really? Yeah. Okay, you heard it here first on the Nolan Show. Right, I'm going to go up against you. I'm going to say Spain. We'll come back on this, will we? Well, look, enjoy it. Let's hope for some good matches anyway. Let's see some good football before it's all through. I'm sure we will. All right, Miguel, thanks very much. Yeah, I'll be watching. It's a nice distraction, isn't it? It's a nice distraction. Thanks to Miguel Delaney there for his comments. Who's going to win the Euro? If you do think it's England, love to hear from you. 0-30-30. 80-55-55. And on the theme of sport, you know, we're talking so much about the Euros, and that's why I think we do get quite excited about the idea of a stadium for the Euros of the future. And of course, we did hear from Hilary Benn, the newly appointed Secretary of State, at the weekend, who told Kelly Bonner that Casement Park will be built. But he has urged people just to bear with him.
Back in April, Secretary of State, you told my colleague Mark Crothers that you do everything in your power to get Casement Park built. You are in power now. Will Casement be built, and can you guarantee it will be built in time to host the Euros?
Well, Casement Park is a very important project. It's been a long-held objective of the executive, as you will be aware. There are two issues. The first is the cost, which has continued to escalate. I think originally when it was conceived, it was going to be something like £77 million. I have yet to receive a full detailed briefing, which I will get tomorrow, on where the current estimated cost, but it's a lot more money than that. And there's a certain amount in the pot, but not enough to cover what is the increased cost. And the second is, of course, we're into, well, definitely extra time on trying to get it built for the Euros. And that's about discussions with UEFA. So I am looking at this urgently. It's probably the most urgent issue on my desk. But one way or another, if it's possible in time for the Euros, if not one way or another, the Casement Park will have to be built to complete the project, which has included, of course, Windsor Park, the Kingspan for football and for rugby, and Casement Park for the GAA. So I'm looking to see what can be done.
Just when will you make that decision? I mean, it's rolling on.
Well,
now,
I think the honest answer is as soon as I am in a position to announce anything. So you just have to bear with me.
Just bear with me. I'm joined now by former UUP Head of Communications, Alex King. Good morning to you, Alex.
Morning, Holly.
Also on the line, former SDLP Special Advisor and GA commentator, Brendan Mulgrew. Good morning, Brendan.
Good morning, Holly. That's Alex.
Alex, I'll start with you. I mean, it's sort of a case of we've got the new people in now, but we don't have to start the conversation again. We don't have to start from the very beginning because, you know, Hilary Benn is fully aware of this situation. He has said it's probably the most pressing issue in his inbox, in fact. So are we likely to hear something soon in terms of a definitive answer?
Well, I think we will, and I think that's why Benn is a crucial appointment, a very important appointment, because we've had a run of secretaries of state over the past few years. To be blunt about it all, they could probably have barely pointed to Northern Ireland on a map. They had no interest in the place, and some of them were appointed simply because there was no one left, you know, at cabinet level, even government level. This is a man who has an interest in Northern Ireland. It's a personal interest. It's a political interest. He is aware. He's over all of it, over everything. He's read about it. He's well, fully briefed. He sounds articulate. He's eloquent. He knows where the main problems are. And I think he also knows, like all good secretaries of state, like all good cabinet ministers, if you can move something quickly, if most of the groundwork's been done already, then move it, chalk it up as a victory, bank it. So I don't know if it'll be a couple of days. I don't know in the long term whether he can guarantee it'll be done before a certain date, because that, in essence, he can put the money, he can put all the money that's required, but you still need all the people who do the building and things like that. But I would be very surprised if in the next few days he doesn't actually just confirm it. Say, look, we, the government, even if you're saying you don't have the money at local level, I as Secretary of State, I'm telling you now that this is getting the go-ahead and we will fund it.
Yeah, and Brendan, what do you make of the comments then? He's kind of saying he's waiting for the new bill, which is understandable. He can't kind of commit to anything until he's literally got the exact figure in front of him.
Yeah, there's a couple of things which are currently impediments to us getting Casement built on time for the Euros. One is the timescale. Mm-hmm. And two, of course, crucially, we all know, you've been discussing it all morning, is the money. But I must say, Holly, that, you know, from the point of view of those of us who do want to see Casement built, and it will be built in some regard, and for those of us who want to see it built in time for the Euros, from moving from a sort of air of dejection and thinking that the opportunity may well have been lost around about a month ago, Jarlath Burns articulated that, the president of the GAA, the election, I think, has changed the context once more and in a positive way. As Alex has pointed out, we now have a Secretary of State who, it's like the old saying, the adults are in the room. I think we now have a Secretary of State in whom we can actually have a little bit of faith that he will deliver on what he says. Previous Secretary of State, Chris Heaton-Harris, literally used the words, "We'll find the money, I guarantee it," Like, literally, that's what he said. And he wrote to say that he would do those things as well. But the Tory government just did not act in good faith and did not deliver on that promise. Now, I think that Hilary Benn is a cut above any of the Secretaries of State we've had in the Tories over the last 14 years. And it's reassuring to hear him say, yes, he is on top of the brief. He's going to find out all the information and he'll make a quick decision. The opportunity is not yet lost. And if we, you know, you've been talking about it with Miguel, albeit you're holding over this, the threat of an England win, God forbid. But just imagine the scenes that are taking place in Germany now. If we lose out here, there'll be huge matches in England, Scotland, Wales and Dublin. And if in 4 years' time we don't get this over the line, we'll be looking at each other thinking, why do we not do this? Whose fault is this? Why is this not happening? Why are there no matches in Belfast? Why are we not taking part in this absolutely huge global sporting competition? So everything which can be done, those of us who are those who hold any area of responsibility for getting Kisset built and on time for the Euros, please pull out all the stops and let us take part in this festival of football in 4 years' time.
What's the deadline, though? And that's the I certainly don't have the answer to that, and I couldn't possibly try to work it out. When's the latest? And as you rightly say, Chris Heaton-Harris had made very similar promises. What's to say that? Yeah. Hilary Benn won't do the same, that will say one way or another, I guarantee it's going to happen. It didn't happen before, so where's the guarantee that it's going to happen now, unless perhaps we have a deadline?
Well, the deadline that UEFA had previously set is a calendar year. Any stadium which is going to host a match as part of the Euro 2020, it has to be up and running a calendar year beforehand. Now, I sense and sort of pick up from conversations that they are prepared to be a little bit more flexible about that, but not quite 12 months.
Well, it can't be deadline. After 2020, yeah.
So by this day next week, the Euros 2024 are history, and we're all looking forward to Euro 2028. So if it means that we can get cases built and operational within 6 months of the competition kicking off instead of 12 months, it gives a little bit more flexibility. But it's a, you know, you walk past or run past or drive past Kisset Park site now, it's a major build that's in store. It's mm-hmm. going to take a long time. But if we're in extra time, we're sort of heading towards injury time of extra time. So we do need decisions almost immediately.
Yeah, and at what point, Alex, do we go to penalties? Because, and it's a big old penalty because, again, we don't even know what the final bill will be at this point. The GAA obviously has said that they've reached their limit. So it is going to go to the British government. And how much could we expect from them?
Well, it is going to go to the British government. And I think the government knows, and the NIO will know as well, that, as Brendan said, that you can't mess about with this sort of thing. You can't keep pushing it and pushing it down the line. So that's why I think, and to be honest, I have no interest in sport of any kind, but I'm just interested in what people talk about, you know, political decisions and so on. I think it's one of those rare things where it's a hugely important thing. The project itself is hugely important. And I think if the Secretary of State and the government want to actually set a very good template for Northern Ireland to say, look, this is how we're going to do this. And we're not going to say, okay, oh, we'll think about it, we'll come back to you in 6 months. I say, maybe I'm being over-optimistic and it's only his third day in and maybe I'm not known for my optimism and things, but I just have this feeling, Holly, that this guy is going to say, right, I'm telling you now, there's the money, there's the timescale. I can't guarantee the people are building it because it's not my area or something like that, but whatever you need in time, we will underwrite it. Just get moving. And I think he will do that.
I'm a bit worried about you, Alex. You sound very optimistic.
Look, phone me in a week and I'll be my old grumpy self again. But right now, thank my optimism, Holly, because it's a rare thing.
Brendan, are you as optimistic? And I actually feel like you both are. I feel like the comments from Hilary Benn at the weekend have kind of given new energy to this. For a long time, it had felt like it had been a very negative conversation. And now there is a positivity, but it is only based on words.
Yeah, I'm optimistic, Holly, on two levels. One, I think that the GAA has been without a stadium now since 2012. And, you know, if we don't make it in time for the Euros, we will get the stadium built that we need and then add some GAA needs, also GAA needs. So that's almost, I think, guaranteed going to happen in some regard. Will it be enough to do on spec and on time for the Euros? Well, you know, the organisations are the bodies which have pledged funding to some degree include our own executive, maybe there's not much room to uplift that. The GAA, I still think the GAA should probably return to the table, be prepared to talk about increasing their contribution. And the Irish government. And, you know, the Irish government wants to see Casement built and built in time for the Euros. Maybe they may, our friends in Dublin may welcome back with an even slightly more generous offer. And then, of course, the fourth leg of that stool is the British government. And I do think we now have a second of state who will not just use words, and I know it's a strong thing to say, but I think we'll move beyond acting in bad faith, and I think we'll act in good faith. So the context or the ingredients are there if quick decisions are made and the right quick decisions are made. So fingers crossed we will get there.
Something tells me we'll be back talking about this in a few days' time. Brendan Mulgrew and Alex Kane, thank you for your time this morning. Can I say thank you for all your texts as well? Lots of you reacting to the football chat a little earlier. Thanks to Michael, who has reminded me that the Euros final is on Friday the 14th. It's Bastille Day. But it's not. It's Sunday. Sorry, Sunday the 14th. That would be some party in France. And Malachi says, I class myself as an Irish nationalist and GAA fan. However, I am cheering on the Orange Men. The Grand Prix on Saturday and the English playing the Dutch. Rock on the Orange Men. We shall leave it there. Thanks very much. I will be back with you tomorrow. Connor Phillips is next.
The biggest show in the country. Listen again on BBC Sounds. Tweet @Stephen Nolan.